From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Honeymoon in Vegas, we talk with Andrew Bergman about writing and directing this hit film comedy. Bergman also wrote and directed The Freshman. He co-wrote Blazing Saddles with Mel Brooks. Later, some of the new words entering our language. We'll talk with Ann Sawanoff, the executive editor of the new edition of the American Heritage Dictionary. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Secret History by Donna Tartt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has overwhelmingly approved $10.5 billion in disaster aid for victims of Hurricanes Andrew and Iniki and Typhoon Omar. The measure included $3 billion to address the devastation caused by Iniki on the Hawaiian island of Kauai and some additional requests from areas battered by Andrew. President Bush and Bill Clinton both addressed the National Guard Association in Utah today. The president had been expected to attack Clinton on his draft record, as NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Governor Clinton headed to California to raise campaign funds, but changed his travel plans to appear before the more than 4,000 uniformed men and women when he heard that the president was going to attack. But the attack never came. President Bush instead indirectly raised the draft issue by calling attention to his own role as commander-in-chief. He then praised his vice president, Dan Quayle's candor, when he was confronted with draft questions in 1988.
Why do these questions even matter? Why are they part of our national debate? They matter because despite all our problems at home, we can never forget that we ask our presidents to lead the military, to bear the awful authority of deciding to send your sons and daughters in harm's way.
Governor Clinton never mentioned the draft in his remarks and instead raised an issue that Mr. Bush is sensitive to. He blamed 12 years of trickle-down economics for the nation's problems and said national security begins with economic security. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Salt Lake City.
The president of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, says he wants to resume negotiations with the South African government in order to save the country from disaster. In a newspaper interview, Mandela said President de Klerk did not have to make any new concessions in order to get the talks underway. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports from Johannesburg.
The interview is perhaps the clearest indication yet of the renewed confidence of Mr. Mandela and his Secretary General Cyril Ramaphosa. The ANC has outlined three issues: a ban on dangerous weapons, improved security at hostels, and the release of political prisoners as the price for a high-profile summit with the government. However, Mr. Mandela says all he requires from the president is a commitment to address the issues. The ANC president also disclosed that he was frightened by the current state of the economy and said mass action could fall away if there was an agreement soon on an interim government of national unity. In what could be interpreted as a criticism of local ANC leaders, Mr. Mandela said they would have to make sure their actions did not impact negatively on national politics. The interview has been welcomed by the Liberal and largely white Democratic Party. A spokesman said there was now an important responsibility on the government to ensure its words and actions strengthen the hand of those who sought peace.
Fergal Keane reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost 49 points today to close at 3,327. This is NPR. Declining export sales helped cause the U.S. trade deficit to soar during the first quarter of the year. The Commerce Department said the gap between what Americans import and what we sell overseas grew to $17.8 billion from April through June. That was up from less than $6 billion in the first quarter, and it was the biggest deficit in about a year and a half. Analysts pointed out that the last few quarterly trade deficits have been reduced by reimbursement payments from the Persian Gulf War. Some experts predict that the trade gap could get much worse as those payments are completed and U.S. exports fail to sell as well in weakening markets overseas. A former Exxon security guard has pleaded guilty to state charges in connection with the kidnapping and murder of Exxon executive Sidney Riso last April. From member station WBGO in Newark, Tony Randolph reports.
Arthur Seale today admitted his role in the fatal kidnapping of Sidney Riso in New Jersey Superior Court, a week after he pleaded guilty to federal charges that he planned and carried out the April 29th abduction and in the process accidentally shot Sidney Riso. Riso died 4 days later. Seale also said that he never meant to kill Riso and only wanted to extort $18 million from the oil company. The ransom was never paid. Seale faces life in prison on the state charges and a fine of up to $2 million. He faces 95 years and a $1.75 million fine for the federal charges. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Randolph reporting.
Inflation remained pretty much in check at the consumer level last month. The Labor Department said today that consumer prices rose by 0.3% in August, about what most analysts had been expecting. Most of the increase came from a sharp rise of almost 1% in retail food prices, much of it in the costs of fruit and vegetables. Transportation-related prices actually declined by 0.1%. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The current hit film comedy, Honeymoon in Vegas, was written and directed by my guest, Andrew Bergman. Bergman also wrote and directed the comedy The Freshman, in which Marlon Brando did a comic turn on his Mafia Don role in The Godfather. Bergman's other screenplays include Fletch, The In-Laws, and Soap Dish. He co-wrote the screenplay for Blazing Saddles with Mel Brooks. Before we meet Bergman, let's hear a scene from Honeymoon in Vegas. Nicolas Cage and Sarah Jessica Parker play a couple who've come to Las Vegas to get married. But Cage is still edgy about making the big commitment. James Caan plays a con man who thinks Sarah Jessica Parker looks just like his beloved late wife. So he tricks Cage into a card game in which Cage loses big. Caan is willing to absolve the debt if Cage loans him his fiancée for the weekend. And of course, Cage has no choice but to reluctantly agree. As Parker packs her bags for this dreaded weekend, Cage is a nervous wreck.
It's only for a few days.
Come on. You're so, like, blithe about this all of a sudden. Like, you don't give a damn!
Of course I give a damn, but this was not my idea, okay, Jack? Poker was not my idea.
Would you please stop crucifying me with this?
See my bag?
He's gonna jump all over you the second he gets there.
Oh, then I'll let him, please, Jack. Give me a little credit.
He'll overcome you. I mean, what happens if you start screaming? It's like a jungle over there! He probably has servants and bodyguards, and believe me, they will drug you!
His son is gonna be there, Jack. His granddaughter, Tiffany, will be there.
She knows the kid's name already.
What was your original idea for the movie? What was the first part of it that you came up with, the new movie?
The first part was very simple. It was just boy-girl. I've had tendency to do movies which were sort of, I don't like to say the word buddy films, but they've been sort of very male films, from Blazing Saddles for The In-Laws and even The Freshman, you know, older man, father-son. I really wanted to do a boy-girl story. So that was the initial impulse. And then I had this idea, well, this guy's going to lose his girlfriend in a poker game. And when I mentioned at the time to my agent, he sort of turned pale, you know, and he said, well, this is 1990s. You can't do something like that. I said, it won't be what you think. So that was the original impulse, was really to do something which was pretty simple and not have Komodo dragons in it and some completely baroque plot which it would take me 2 years to figure out.
Is that what happened with The Freshman?
It was the hardest. I wrote that script over a period of 3 years. I just kept painting myself into a corner. I never had any idea how I was going to get out of it.
Well, there were all these shifting identities and subplots.
Yeah, it's a very complicated script.
So let me ask you your agent's question. Why did you think you could get away with having a guy lose his girl in a poker game?
Because I knew I would do it in such a way as to not offend, I think. I it was never intended to be. You know, people who see the premise say, oh, what a sexist kind of thing. But it really isn't at all when you see the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have Sarah Jessica Parker plays really a very independent girl. She wants to get married. She tells Nicolas Cage she wants to get married. She's calling the shots. And the turning point in her relationship with Jimmy Caan, who takes her off to Hawaii, is really that he really treats her like a possession, basically. He walks around with her like a possession, and that's something that she can't just tolerate. So she's a completely contemporary person, and she goes off with Jimmy not because she's been traded off, but out of rage. You know, it's her decision to go off to Hawaii with Jimmy Caan.
You have many Elvis impersonators in the movie. How did you get them into the story, and then how did you find them once you wrote them in?
I always wanted to do a movie which took place during a convention of Elvis impersonators. Always. And this was...
Why?
Because I just thought visually it would be a wonderful thing to see.
Mm-hmm.
That every time the elevator opened, five Elvises would walk out. You walk past the newsstand and there's three Elvises reading newspapers. And in Vegas, of course, nothing is out of place. You know, if there were 100 people naked in the lobby, it wouldn't be out of place in Vegas. Vegas is a place in which nothing can be out of place, you know. And they fit in, you know, it was like lions in the jungle. It was their natural habitat.
So did you find the Elvis impersonators, or did you ask people to play them?
Oh, we did
as
a
well?
Sort of calling all Elvises search, and we got tapes from all over the country, all over the world, really, you know, our casting people.
Nicolas Cage gives a fantastic performance in Honeymoon in Vegas. Was it your idea to cast him?
Well, that was my idea to cast everybody because I'm the director. But, I mean, originally he was not my thought. You know, Nick's movies have been so out there, you know, eating roaches and all those things he's done in pictures that when you do a romantic comedy, the first name that would not have popped in my head was Nicolas Cage. But when he read the script and really had a fierce desire to do it, which a director always likes, because when you have to talk someone into doing a part, it never turns out well. It's just something you don't want to do. Because if things ever go bad on a picture, and at some point they always do, you have an actor who says, I knew it, you know. So in this case, I would never have had that problem. And the other thing is he came in and read, and he just was this guy. I mean, he owned the part. And there was just no question from that moment on that he was going to play, you know, Jack Singer in the movie.
Were there particular line readings that really surprised you in where he put the accent or how he'd go from loud to soft in one paragraph?
Well, Nick can just go off on a dime, which is what I love about him, you know. And in the movie, he is so harried that it never seems completely inappropriate. He did a line reading on when he visits this Hawaiian chief, played by Peter Boyle in the movie, in which Pat Morita is this cab driver who is taking him there for the purpose of diverting him. And he lives in this run-down, ramshackle place. And Nick doesn't want to set foot in the place. And Pat Morita says, you really should be respectful to him. He's a man of great influence on this island. And Nick did this reading. He said, influence? He lives in a shack! And he exploded on the word shack. And when he did it, the first take was ruined because the producer who was sitting listening to earphones just broke out laughing. It was so funny. So he has a wonderful way of just... exploding, literally exploding on a particular word.
Well, it must be fun for you as the writer to hear somebody like bring the words to life in such a surprising way.
Nick does it as well as anybody I have ever worked with. In fact, I think not since Peter Falk in The In-Laws did I ever work with an actor who just absolutely had ingested the rhythms of what I had written. And just did it. You know, it's like, you know, music to my ears. He really nailed everything. Also, Nick has fabulous diction. I mean, you understand every word he says, which is, you know, not the common thing in movies nowadays. You know, when you're straining to hear what actors are saying half the time, Nick really knocks him out.
My guest is Andrew Bergman, who wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas and also The Freshman. I want to ask you about The Freshman, your film from a couple of years ago, where Matthew Broderick plays a young man from Vermont who's going to New York to study in film school. And within a minute of arriving in New York, all of his possessions are ripped off in a scam. And then he's soon involved in what he figures is the mafia, which is headed by Marlon Brando, looking suspiciously like Don Corleone. There's a great scene, a couple of scenes with his film teacher and faculty advisor, who's incredibly pretentious.
Right.
And the first time we see this film teacher, it's in his office, and Matthew Broderick has come in to explain he doesn't have any money to buy books. And the teacher's listening to Shuffle Off to Buffalo, which has the line, and the wheels go slow, soon we're going to shuffle off to Buffalo. And he explains that he's writing a paper called And the Wheels Go Slow, Film and Function in 42nd Street.
Right.
I thought that was a wonderfully funny line, and then, of course, I found out that you did your dissertation on Depression-era movies, and that's called We're in the Money. Was this a little joke on yourself?
Fleabre is there, but for the grace of God, go on. I mean, I would have been Professor Fleabre. In fact, one of the props in that scene was he had my book on his desk, We're in the Money, which I wrote 20 years ago, and which, amazingly enough, is still in print. So it was really sort of a joke on myself. I mean, Fleabag was sort of one of my own worst visions of what I probably would have turned into if I'd continued in the path that I had chosen.
Well, there's another wonderful scene where, the professor, Fleaver is showing Godfather 2
right.
to the class, and he's, like, lip-syncing with all the parts on the side of the room.
I'm Senator. You can have my answer now if you like. My offer is this. Nothing. Not even the fee for the gaming license, which I would appreciate if you would put up personally.
Senator... My offer is this. Nothing. In that one moment, Michael Corleone says that all corruption is equal, that there is no separation between politics and gangsterism. Now, in the Fleabag treatise, Guns and Provolone, what point is made about the similarities between Karl Marx's Das Kapital, Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and the Lake Tahoe scene from Godfather 2, Mr. Kellogg?
Sir.
You haven't read the Fleabag piece?
Well, I'm...
You need tutorial help from Mr. Bushek?
No, sir.
Mr. Glassman.
In an evolving society, violence and narcissism replace...
Shut up!
I hate this guy.
Did you have teachers like this when you were in film school?
Everybody. I was never in film
school.
You
were never in film school?
No, never in film school.
All right.
But everybody's had teachers like this. If it's not in film, it's in something else. Overbearing guys who you instantly know in your gut are full of it, but you still, even after the first class, know you're going to have to spend 14 weeks in purgatory with these people. So Fleabag, I really had fun with Fleabag. And poor Benedict, who played him, was just unbelievably funny, I thought. I just loved him. When he gives the speech, he starts off by trying to sound like Pacino. You know, that's the other joke within the film, within the film. He does his own pitiful parody of Al giving that speech. It was really fun.
Now, your major at the University of Wisconsin was American Intellectual History. What exactly were you planning to do with that?
Well, what does anybody plan to do with American Intellectual History? I guess be an American intellectual, and look good in tweed suits and get tasseled loafers, Baswegians, and think thoughts. What I liked about American Intellectual History was the research. And going into primary documents and digging through things. And actually, the book on movies was fascinating to do because I was sort of rummaging around all kinds of stuff. It's like rummaging around the attic of the 1930s and making connections with all kinds of things in literature and popular literature. So it was really interesting work. I thought when I was in college, I thought I'd get a degree and then I'd wind up advising a president, I went to college in the 60s, and I thought, boy, I'd like to be Ted Sorensen when I grow up, sit there next to Kennedy and tell him how to be a genius. I thought that's what I would do.
So tell me something about your thesis on Depression-era movies.
Well, I mean, the thesis was that in the early 30s, when things were really desperate, what the movies did in different forms was to keep alive the great American success stories. And what I did when I studied a movie like Little Caesar, for instance, I compared it to Horatio Alger stories. I compared it to this essay that Andrew Carnegie had written about success in the 19th century. And I found that what Edward G. Robinson did in that movie was everything that Andrew Carnegie said you had to do to be a success. Stay away from women, very disciplined, no booze. He worked very hard. He just, in the early 30s, to start a small business and be successful when 37 million people were out of work wouldn't have been credible. So to me, gangster stories were success stories. And then as things got perceived as better in the mid-30s, things started to shift. And the government became a character in a lot of movies, and Warner Brothers movies, and began to seem as benevolent. But if you look at movies in the very early 30s, they're very scary. I mean, you can see the amount of terror that was floating around.
Yeah, of course, these guys are all punished for their success.
Ultimately.
Yeah. Of course, they had to be, I guess, because of the Hays Code.
Exactly.
So how did you go from writing about movies to writing movies?
Well, the first good thing that happened to me was I couldn't get a teaching job. That was my first break. So I went to work for United Artists for a year as a PR guy, and I met a lot of really fascinating people, because at that time United Artists was releasing something like 35 movies a year. And I met Fellini, I met Truffaut, all these people I was spending time with. And it was a great education. I made a lot of contacts. And during that time, I wrote the story that became Blazing Saddles. It's an idea I'd had for years of a black sheriff in the Old West. And I sold it to Warner Brothers, and I never worked an honest day in my life again.
The scene that always gets talked about the most is the bean scene, where they're sitting around eating beans and then sitting around passing a lot of air.
Right.
But I love things like the quicksand. You know, I mean, there's quicksand in every Western of a certain period, you know. And I you could tell me quicksand doesn't exist and I'd believe you, but for some reason it had to be in every Western.
It was always one of my nightmares as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, quicksand. I mean, mm-hmm. It's the scariest thing you can think of, you know. The thing about Blazing Saddles is, now in retrospect, critics write about it as this seminal picture. But we got blasted when it came out. I mean, some critics liked it, but we got roasted a lot.
I think my favorite moment in the movie is when the chain gang, the prisoners are asked to, sing a work song, and they break out into
Cole
I
Porter.
Get a Kick Out of You. Yeah.
It's great.
What was it like when that idea was generated?
You just don't know anymore,
right?
Because at that point there are five people sitting around a room throwing these things around, and it's like a game of telephone. It starts as one thing, and a half hour later it's something else, and you don't know anymore what was yours and what was someone else's, and it didn't really make any difference. It was pretty egoless, the writing on that picture.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Andrew Bergman, and he wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas and The Freshman. He wrote So Fine and The In-Laws, and he also wrote the story for Blazing Saddles. So more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and director Andrew Bergman is my guest. His current film is the hit Honeymoon in Vegas. I want to get back to a couple of things about The Freshman and see how they connect with you. Was it hard to get Marlon Brando to work on the film and to basically do an almost parody version of Don Corleone, his role in The Godfather?
Well, he wanted to play it that way, so I didn't have to twist his arm. It was his idea. I didn't write that script for Brando originally. I mean, because who would think he was doing movies anymore? I thought that, Pacino or Joe Mantegna, or one of those guys, would play it. When he finished the script, we basically sent it to Brando on the off chance that he'd want to do it. And he called me the day after he got the script and said he was interested. So it was not at all difficult to get him to do it. I don't think... It's thought of as a parody of that character. But I always thought he started with that guy and then we took him somewhere else. I mean, if you look at The Godfather and you look at The Freshman, he's a very different guy. It's sort of the Falstaff version of Don Corleone. I think it's one of the best things Brando ever did, if you consider what the expectations were and where he took that guy.
I've seen the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, and it's a fabulous movie.
Yeah, and in that you see...
See Brando torturing Francis.
Exactly. Exactly, and you see him trying to, improvise and then saying to Coppola, "I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore today." And I'm thinking, wow, I mean, this guy is a brilliant actor, but, gee, he must be awfully difficult to work with.
Well, he wasn't difficult for me to work with. But, I mean, improvising, I don't believe in it.
You're the writer. I can see why.
Well, not just for that. It doesn't work. I mean, it just doesn't work. It's interminable. I mean, they're actors for a reason, and they're writers for a reason. They're two separate functions. I mean, and none of the actors in Honeymoon, nor did any of the actors in Freshman, have any desire to improvise. They were very happy with the lines, you know. I mean, there's always leeway, But it makes no more sense to me for actors to improvise than for me to get up and start acting. They're very separate things. I mean, it can be good in rehearsal because you can find things. But once the cameras are rolling, I'm not a big believer in it at all.
What about Brando? Did he want to improvise?
No, not at all. He loved the lines.
So was it difficult to work with him?
No. It was, you know, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, like 2 weeks before shooting, and said, what am I doing? Am I out of my mind? You know, I've heard this guy said, just a director eater. But he was wonderful. I mean, he took direction, you know, he was craving direction, I guess, because he hadn't done much comedy. And he didn't feel as secure in it. But he was just wonderful, and he couldn't have been better to the other actors. I mean, he was wonderful. You know, when he do off-camera things, you know, when someone else is close-up, you know, some actors just basically do nothing because they're not on screen. But he would working as hard as he could. He was wonderful. He was just absolutely wonderful. And shows on screen. His pleasure in the part, he's astounding. You know, he rehearsed ice skating. I mean, this is a guy's reputation for hating to work. He would go practice ice skating every day. It was quite wonderful.
He gave an interview, I think, right before the movie opened.
No, it was the day after shooting. He'd fallen on the ice and hurt his neck.
Uh-huh.
And I have a feeling he had sucked on too much Percodan before he gave this interview. It was always my theory. And he was having this dispute with the TriStar because they thought he thought they owed him an extra, I don't know what it was, $50,000 because he worked an extra day. And he gets some environmental reporter from the Toronto Star in there, and he just went bonkers, you know. And then he retracted it. Now, of course, the retraction was carried in, you know, 4 newspapers in the world. But it was a disaster. It was just, and he has the self-destructive thing. I mean, he does it all the time. He just did it on Columbus, saying what a terrible picture it was. I mean, in that case, it turned out to be true.
So what did he say about The Freshman? He said the film's going to be a flop.
He said the film's going to be a flop. It was a terrible experience. I mean, none of which was true. I mean, he'd had the time of his life doing it. And he couldn't have been better to work with. It was just, you know, a very self-destructive and idiotic thing to do.
So do you know what you're going to be doing next?
There are a couple of things I'm considering. One is a very old idea, and one is something I'm just working on. I would love to do something political. We were talking about advising presidents before.
Yeah.
I think we're ripe for a really good, dark political comedy. There hasn't been a good one since Strangelove, in my humble opinion, and I would love to do one.
Is that hard to do in Hollywood?
I don't. I I'm coming off a hit, so when you,
right.
You know, if you have a hit picture, then you have the luxury of saying, I'd like to do a movie called The Lawn next. And they say, that sounds interesting. The Lawn, it could be good. Is this like a big lawn or just like a backyard thing? So I don't know. So that's the, you know, the luxury of having a movie that's number one is that they're quicker to say yes to something.
Yeah, it's been number one for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
What else does that get you?
I think that's the main thing it gets you. It's not, I mean, if it hadn't been successful, it wouldn't be that I would never work in this town again. You know, The Freshman wasn't commercially all that successful, but it, you know, here I was 2 years later making a movie. But what a hit gives you, someone says it gives you 3 flops. You know, I can make 3 turkeys in a row, but I'll still say, you know, he made Honeymoon in Vegas, and that really did very well. So there's always a chance. It just gives you breathing room is what it does. It means the studios say, well, it's worth taking a shot. You know, this looks crazy, but who knows, you know? Honeymoon in Vegas looked crazy, and look what happened.
Andrew Bergman wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, laptop, comfort food, stress test, prequel. These are four of the 10,000 new words included in the latest edition of the American Heritage Dictionary. We'll talk words with Anne Suwanoff, the dictionary's executive editor. Donna Tartt's first novel, The Secret History, is about a group of classics majors at a New England college who plot a murder. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Both President Bush and Democratic challenger Bill Clinton appeared today before a meeting of the National Guard Association in Salt Lake City, but they avoided a major confrontation over Clinton's draft status during the Vietnam War. Speaking later today in San Jose, California, Clinton said that this presidential election is about putting the American dream back in reach again, and said that the nation needs an economic program that creates jobs through investment. Speaking today in Inglewood, Colorado, Mr. Bush told a rally that Clinton cannot be trusted with the responsibilities of being president. Mark Roberts reports.
The president's speech offered a kind of smorgasbord of Bush-Quayle re-election campaign themes. America must be a military and economic superpower. America must strengthen the family and must offer parents the chance to choose their children's schools. The president also charged his Democratic opponent, Bill Clinton, wants to raise taxes, and alluded to the idea that Clinton cannot be trusted.
It'll be like going back to the used car lot, picking up the lemon that you sold 12 years ago, only this time it would have higher prices on it from inflation, skyrocketing interest rates for credit, and a hot air bag thrown in.
Finally, the president said he may be behind in the polls, but pledged the Bush-Quayle ticket would win in November. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved $10.5 billion in disaster aid for hurricane victims in several states. $3 billion was added for residents of Hawaii, where a hurricane hit over the weekend. Laura Kanoi reports.
Roughly half of the $3 billion is direct aid and half loans. The Senate added the money to a $7.5 billion package for storm victims in Florida, Louisiana, and Guam. Hurricane Iniki hit Hawaii on Friday. It killed at least three people and caused an estimated $1 billion in damages on the island of Kauai alone. Hawaii Senator Daniel Akaka visited the island this weekend.
In simple words, Kauai is a scene of unimaginable devastation.
Akaka stressed that the damage estimates from Iniki are still sketchy. He warned Hawaii may need more federal money once the full extent of the destruction is clear. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoi in Washington.
Retail sales were off 0.5% last month for the worst report since March. The Commerce Department says orders for those big-ticket items, including cars and furniture, had their largest drop in 18 months. Many economists had thought sales would drop only 0.1% in August instead of the larger 0.5% figure. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 49 points to close at 3,327.32 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, government troops have been forced to fall back in fighting against Serbian forces around the capital city of Sarajevo. Over the last 24 hours, the government says 80 people have been killed in fresh fighting and more than 370 others have been wounded. After heavy shelling yesterday, very few people have been seen in the center of the capital as Serbian forces pushed forward. A UN spokesman in Geneva said today the Bosnian foreign minister will attend peace talks later this week after dropping a threat to boycott because of continued Serbian attacks. Thunderstorms have dropped more than 11 inches of rain in southern Iowa, closing schools and major roads. As Mark Moran reports from member station WOI, there is no immediate relief in sight.
Heavy rain started early Monday and hasn't let up since. Hundreds of miles of local roads and several miles of Interstate 35 have been flooded by creeks, streams, and rivers that have rushed over their banks. Governor Branstad has signed an emergency proclamation for 5 counties in southern Iowa. His spokesman Dick Voss says the creeks and streams are continuing to rise.
We've got a bad situation down there. It's flash flood conditions. For example, the Sheridan River, at last count, was at 24.7 feet. That's above the 16-foot flood stage. It's more than a foot above the record.
Flood victims were hoping for some relief by tonight, but that was before the National Weather Service updated its forecast to include a good chance for more thunderstorms. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
A former security guard has pleaded guilty for the second time to kidnapping and murder charges in the abduction of Exxon official Sidney Riso. Last week, Arthur Seal pleaded guilty to federal charges, and today he pleaded guilty to state charges. Riso was kidnapped last April, and he died 4 days later. Seal faces a maximum sentence of life in prison and fines of up to $2 million. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Dictionaries aren't just the arbiters of what's right and wrong. They're a reflection of how our language is always changing. To keep up with these changes, the American Heritage Dictionary has just published its 3rd edition. In a New York Times review, it was described as, quote, surely the most pleasurable dictionary ever published in this country and one of the most useful, unquote. This dictionary not only gives you definitions, spellings, and derivations, there are short essays about word histories and usage. My guest, Anne Suwanoff, is the executive editor. And in the interest of full disclosure, we should say that Fresh Air linguist Jeffrey Nunberg is the chair of the usage panel. It's been 10 years since the previous edition of the American Heritage Dictionary. I wanted to know why the time was right for a new one.
10 to 12 years traditionally has been the life cycle of an adult abridged dictionary, chiefly because lexicographers need to watch the language to see how much is changing and what is changing. We expect in the future that given major societal changes and world changes, such as the ones we've seen just in the past 2 or 3 years, the life cycle of the adult dictionary may decrease to, say, 6 years or 7 years. Also, computer technology has now enabled lexicographers to make changes and craft new editions with much more ease than in the past.
Any idea how many words are in the new dictionary that weren't in the previous dictionary?
About 10,000 new words and about 6,000 new senses of existing words.
One of the fields, so to speak, that's really changed a lot in the last 10 years is slang, and you know, street slang, and thinking, for instance, all the words that have come out of rap music and hip-hop culture. Now, hip-hop is in your new dictionary, but words like chill and deaf aren't in it. How do you decide which words from, you know, street talk and musical slang are going to make it in?
For one thing, we read and mark a wide variety of newspapers, news magazines, specialized journals, sports publications, novels, and so forth, nonfiction books, over the long term so that we get an idea of new terms that are coming into the language. And we also get an idea of how certain terms that might be stigmatized as slang are being used by the best writers across the country. Also, we used computer scanning to get hundreds of millions of examples of words in context in reputable publications across the country. If we accrued substantial evidence quantitatively and over time, and by over time I mean 5 to 7 years in a diverse group of publications, evidence that a particular word like homeboy or yo, if that word is being used in a broad group of printed publications that are deemed mainstream publications, then we consider entering the word in the dictionary. And therefore, we do have some terms from the hip-hop culture.
You write the Word Watch column for The Atlantic magazine, in which you keep up with new words that are entering the vocabulary.
Yes.
Let me ask you about one of those words. I've never heard this before. It's an interesting one, shoulder surfing.
Oh, yes. There are lots of surfings going on in the country right now, and shoulder surfing, of course, is a way of gaining access to someone else's telephone credit card, for example, or in a computerized work setting, perhaps gaining entry to a particular computer system and learning the codes by watching over another person's shoulder. And indeed, at airports, shoulder surfers sometimes operate from balconies. It really should be called balcony surfing. They will get up on a balcony over a concourse, and either with binoculars or some other means of vision, attempt to gain access to people's telephone records and access cards.
Velcroid is a good term. Tell us what that means and how you first started tracking it.
Oh, Velcroid was brought to our attention by some of the readers of the column. And our readers are very, very good word watchers. They suggest words and often send us citations to attest the occurrence. Velcroid is particularly interesting because it is a takeoff on the trademark Velcro, and Velcroid actually means a person who is usually either in the inner circle or on the fringes of the inner circle of a political leader. Could be anybody, the president of our country or a prime minister or whatever, and this person tries to insert himself or herself into every photo opportunity just to create a stronger image in the press.
So they're clinging to somebody famous.
Absolutely.
As if attached by Velcro to get them in the limelight.
Yes.
What are some of the words you're watching right now?
That's a great question. One of the things that we're watching is Zero Parent, Zero Hyphen Parent, as in Zero Parent Child and Zero Parent Family, because we know that there are probably 2.8 million of these children in the country, children who have no parents at all because the parents have either died, have been murdered, have been put in prison, or have simply abandoned the children. Another one is decession, D-E-C-E-S-S-I-O-N, which refers to the economic climate.
I want to say the word that you mentioned, decession, that's a compound of depression and recession, right?
That's correct.
So new social change and economic change requires new words to describe it?
Quite often, and then senses change of existing words. Family, for example, has changed considerably in its definition during the last 25 years, and so has retire.
Hang on, I'm going to look up family in the dictionary.
Okay.
I noticed, by the way, family values is not it's not in here.
No, it's not. But what I'm going to say certainly has something to do with that.
Okay, hang on.
You want to look at senses 1A and 1B.
Okay. 1A is a fundamental social group in society, typically consisting of a man and woman and their offspring. 1B is two or more people who share goals and values, have long-term commitments to one another, and reside usually in the same dwelling place.
Yes, those are the new definitions of family in the third edition of the American Heritage Dictionary. And if you notice, they contain qualifiers, and they're also very broad. Since 1A states categorically that this fundamental social group typically consists of a man and a woman and their offspring, so it allows for many possibilities. Since 1B does not specify gender, it allows for single parents, and it does not specify marital vows. Now, you may want to hear what the dictionary said 25 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah.
Here's the definition from the first edition of the American Heritage Dictionary for family. Quote, "The most instinctive, fundamental, social, or mating group in man and animal, especially the union of man and woman through marriage and their offspring, parents and their children." So gender is specified. actually, people seem to be grouped with animals. It is specified that it's a mating group, and marriage is specified. So you can see how far people have grown and gone since 1969. And the point of this, of course, is that lexicographers have to be extremely careful when words such as family are used in the press or in politics, for example. We have to know exactly what is meant by family.
Ann Suwanov is the executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ann Suwanov, the executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary. There's a lot of interesting usage notes in the new American Heritage Dictionary. And some of the interesting notes have to do with languages that apply to different ethnic groups or to gender.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, under the word black, there's an interesting note about whether black as it applies to African Americans should be capitalized or not. And the note points out that if you capitalize black, then should you capitalize white? And if you capitalize white, that implies that whites make up a single ethnic group, which they don't. On the other hand, if you capitalize black and you don't capitalize white, it will raise questions about whether why the writer has distinguished between the two groups. And the entry ends by saying there's no entirely happy solution to this problem. In all likelihood, uncertainty as to the mode of styling of white has dissuaded many publications from adopting the capitalized form black. I think it's really interesting that instead of giving you a simple answer, this note tries to make sense of what's happening in the culture, how people are reacting to the usage, and then basically leaves it up to you to decide.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And the same holds true with color. Person, people, man, woman of color. We handle that particular issue in the same way. And we also point out that this particular locution, which had been used a number of years ago, has now been revived for use with reference to African Americans, Asians, Native Americans, and so forth. And we even include a quote from Jesse Jackson at the usage note for color. And we point out that person of color or people of color is regarded by many as being a better word than the word minority, because, in fact, many of the people in this particular group are not minorities by number at all. And so we do try to alert our readers to possible problems that they might have in using terms such as Hispanic or Chicano or Native American in our usage notes. We also cover issues of sexual preference and physical challenge and, of course, gender, because changes in gender in English really represent probably the most important shift in a language usage during the past 400 years.
What was one of the more thorny issues surrounding gender-related language that you had to deal with?
Well, I think probably the generic pronoun he. He has a usage note that goes over 80 lines, as does the usage note at the word man. But the exciting thing that we found out is this, that most of the usage panel, male and females, have taken into account at least some of the concerns that the feminist movement raised many years ago. And a good example of that concern is this one. Less than 40% of the usage panelists would use the masculine pronoun his in the following sentence, quote, "A child who wants to become a doctor should be encouraged by blank parents and teachers. So we found that the usage panel actually did serve as a bellwether or a sounding board or whatever to the kinds of changes that we had already noted going on across the country in edited and unedited prose.
Well, let me say, the real good news, I thought, on this particular usage question was that a lot of people on the panel said it's okay to say if a child wants to be a doctor, their parents should encourage them.
Mm-hmm.
And I use this solution all the time. Instead of saying his or her parents should encourage them, it would have to be his or her parents should encourage him or her.
Yes, and it gets
so cumbersome.
Yes.
So I use the plural, which is not related to gender, they, them, their. It's gender-free. And then I'm always having people call me up and criticizing me because didn't I know they is plural, whereas child is singular. But I think it's a really perfectly okay solution, and I was thrilled that a lot of the people on your dictionary thought it was perfectly okay, too.
Yes, and that's an example of how people change the language.
Right, so you're watching us as much as we're referring to you.
Absolutely.
Are there new words that are coming from the realm of bureaucracy?
Oh, yes, corpocracy, for example, which means the corporate bureaucracy, for example. Words such as eurocrat, E-U-R-O-C-R-A-T, bridge both the bureaucracy of the corporation and of the government. Narco-kleptocracy, which is a portmanteau word. It means a government that is basically run by a shadow government of drug dealers.
How often do you refer to a dictionary yourself?
All the time.
What do you use it for?
I use it chiefly to check spellings and meanings and very, very often to look up the histories of different words. And I'm always surprised when I go into the word histories, even though I've read them many, many times during the course of editing. I find it very exciting to look up sunbeam, for example, and discover that that word came into the language in the writings of King Alfred the Great during the Dark Ages.
Anne Suwanov is the executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary's new third edition. She also writes the Word Watch column for The Atlantic magazine. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, are you following President Bush and Governor Clinton today?
Right out to the National Guard meeting in Utah, where both candidates spoke, Terry. We are also going to do a special piece on Governor Clinton's record with the draft in the Vietnam War and see if we can't lay it all out and get it straight. We have a piece about the Charlotte Observer, which apparently is paying very strict attention to issues as kind of an experiment and a new way of covering politics, not chasing ambulances, but covering issues. We're going to talk about health care in the campaign, what doctors think ought to be done, and we have a long piece on problems Gulf War veterans brought back.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. First-time novelists are lucky if they get any attention at all. Donna Tartt is getting a lot of attention for her new novel, The Secret History. She even got a $450,000 advance. Our book critic, John Leonard, read the book to see if it measures up to all the hoopla.
Never mind that Donna Tartt's first novel is dedicated to Bret Easton Ellis, and that somebody very much like the Brat Pack bad boy shows up in its pages as a dope pusher with mob connections. Never mind either that Hampton College in Tartt's Secret History sounds a lot like the Camden College we heard about in Ellis's novel, Rules of Attraction, and in Jill Eisenstadt's novel, From Rockaway, in which there was also a character a lot like Ellis. And never mind, while you're at it, that Hampton and Camden in Vermont both resemble Bennington, which is the college in Vermont where Tartt, Ellis, and Eisenstadt were also unhappy. Never mind, at least for a while, because during the first third of her 524-page novel, Tartt, not at all like Ellis and Eisenstadt, is actually writing about education. We spend time in a classroom listening to a professor. Students even discuss the books they're reading as if there were a point to college. Abstract ideas about beauty and terror and the ancient Greeks are entertained as if there were something else to do with your mind besides blowing it. And over these pages there is a golden glow, like the young Fitzgerald or Evelyn Waugh in Brideshead Revisited. No wonder poor Richard, from the wrong side of the California tracks, is taken in by such princely hothouse figures as Henry and Francis and Bunny and Charles and Camilla. Even when this gilded group manages, by accident, in the middle of an attempt at recreating the Dionysian revels, to murder and dismember a New England chicken farmer, well, Richard forgives them. And when, to protect themselves, they throw one of their own over a cliff, Richard will assist them, as languid in his ambivalence as the pale Camilla. The secret history doesn't go entirely downhill in its last several hundred pages. There are patches of terrific landscape writing, some interesting weather, a very funny TV quiz show, and a perfectly dreadful funeral. But comeuppance for this vampire support group is a long time come-upping. And as guilt takes over, so does an excess of drinking and drugging, of contempt and disdain, of violence and sexual misadventure equally unhappy whether it's straight or gay or incestuous. I don't blame these Bennington Brat Pack novelists for festering together in downtown New York after-hours clubs and sneaking each other into their books. It causes publishing industry buzz, as well as review attention. And young writers have always slummed together, seeming to move in a mass like thick-skinned ungulates. It was the same in Paris before the Revolution, when everybody wrote pornography, and after World War II, when everybody was absurd. It happened, too, in St. Petersburg, when Belinsky got mad at Gogol, for which Dostoevsky was almost shot, and in Sussex, where Joseph Conrad, Henry James, and H.G. Wells combed each other's thinning hair, in Bloomsbury and Dingling's China and the Algonquin Hotel, on the French Riviera, at the Partisan Review, and among the North Beach Beats. But while we're waiting around for one of these ungulates to turn into a unicorn, I do feel sorry for poor Bennington.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audra Vlahos and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dr. Thomas Starzl, the surgeon who directed the team that recently transplanted a baboon liver to a human being. Dr. Starzl is a pioneer in the field of organ transplants. 30 years ago, he performed the first human liver transplant. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.